Today's Taisho is Yang Shan's Mind and Environment. Yeah, this is case 32 in the Book of Serenity, Yang Shan's Mind and Environment. Introduction: the ocean is the world of dragons disappearing and appearing. They sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. Does the exhausted fish stop in the shoals and the sluggish bird rest in the reeds? Is there any way to figure gain and loss? Case: Yang Shan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yang Shan said, "What do you think of that?" Yang Shan said, "Do you think of that place?" The monk said, "I always think of it." Yang Shan said, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and the land mass, buildings, towers, halls, and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thoughts to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there?" The monk said, "When I get there, I don't see any existence at all." Yang Shan said, "This is right for the stage of faith, but not right for the stage of the person." The monk said, "Don't you have any other particular way of guidance?" Yang Shan said, "To say that I have anything particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you get only one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe. After this, see on your own." Verse: all embracing with no outside, penetrating with no obstruction, gates and walls like cliffs, doors and locks redoubled. When the wine is always sweet, it lays out the guests. Though the meal is filling, it ruins the farmers. Bursting out of the clear sky, the Garuda takes wing on the wind. Treading over the blue sea, thunder follows the roaming dragon. So I want to thank everybody for sitting so well this morning, both here in this room and also online. Everybody's sitting really still, very deeply in samadhi. Thank you for your wonderful effort. Today's Taisho is really a wonderful, today's koan is really a wonderful koan. Maybe the best way to lead into it is to provide a little bit of background, not in the koan, but like in our own history, right? You know, modern people put a huge amount of attention on or emphasis on consciousness. And we really spend most of our time living in the world created by what we call in Zen the small mind, the conscious mind. And giving so much time and attention, lavishing so much time and attention on consciousness has produced something really extraordinary, which is computers, Zoom, trains, planes, and it's all actually happened in a relatively short period of time. You know, apparently there was a pretty big library in Egypt at the end of the classical period, and it contained a very large number of books, like tens of thousands of books. And it was destroyed. People aren't exactly sure how. There was a fire. It might have been set by religious fanatics. It might have just been a dusty old building that burnt. A lot of that was destroyed. And in China, too, you know, you had a pretty extensive literary record going back to, like, you know, to the Shang Dynasty, that kind of thing. But all the same, you know, those books, which were in the thousands or maybe the tens of thousands, don't compare at all to what we have today. You know, we publish tens and tens of thousands of books every year. It's astonishing. And we publish so many books that there's a crisis. People don't know how to store them all. We've produced so much information, people don't know how to store it all. You know, libraries buy books, academic books, academic libraries buy academic books because there aren't enough readers to make them commercially successful. And that doesn't mean they're not important. You know, some of the most interesting books I've ever read in my life probably never sold more than 10,000 copies, you know? And I think, thank God somebody wrote this. It's such an important book. So the fact that there aren't lots of readers is neither here nor there. What I'm really interested in is that we just, within a relatively short period of time, like, you know, really 300 or 400 years, knowledge has just exploded. It's just the production of information. It keeps growing. You know, there are experts who say that, like, every year and a half, we double the amount of knowledge we have. As you know, it doesn't even make sense. But in terms of the knowledge we produce, medical knowledge, technical knowledge, you know, on and on, that knowledge doubles like every year and a half, and they say it's actually going to become like it's going to double every 4 months or something in a predictable amount of time. And, you know, on the one hand, this is like a success story, right? And, you know, so much, knowledge used to be so scarce that if a person had a couple of books and had read them, like in the Middle Ages, if you had like 10 books, you were considered like a genius. You know, you had this big collection of books. And if you actually read them, you were like in this tiny minority, right? So knowledge used to be so scarce, a lot of people in the United States had like one, they had the Bible, that was it, right, in their house, you know. So and they didn't read it typically, right? So we used to be information poor, and now we're information rich. And we have the internet. We have, you know, if you when I finish sitting in the evening, sometimes I'll go downstairs and my wife is watching cable television. She's watching like HBO, Apple Plus, there's Disney Prime, there's all these channels, and they all produce these shows, right? So there's just this staggering amount of information. And in a certain sense, you know, that feels like a real success story. And I myself put a great deal of value on knowledge, you know, so I'm not ridiculing knowledge, you know. Knowing history, knowing the truth about what might have happened, having access to literature that might be thousands of years old, this is precious information. So I'm not criticizing this. I'm just saying, you know, we have created this knowledge society that is, in one sense, like very spectacularly wonderful. But in another sense, you know, it's created a real imbalanced human being. Because we live so much in the conscious mind, so much in the world of information and consciousness, that we really don't have touch with other parts of our own awareness, right? And we usually describe this as the unconscious mind. In the West, we call this the unconscious mind. And, you know, one of the reasons we need psychologists and psychotherapists and counselors. One of the reasons is that our society is so unbalanced. It has put so much emphasis on consciousness that it doesn't really have, it's kind of ignorant about or blind to the importance of the unconscious. You know, if you think about consciousness, you know, many scientists say, for example, you know, consciousness is like the tip of an iceberg, and your mental life is like this giant iceberg, most of which is below the surface of consciousness. So, you know, if that's true, what we've done is we've created this way of life that is very, very invested in the tip of the iceberg, and really has very little wisdom, we could say, about or knowledge of what's under the surface, right? And the result is that we have like we've become like very unbalanced people. I would say that in the modern world, we've become unbalanced people. The more, there's nothing wrong with reading and studying. There's nothing wrong with archival research. I've done it myself, you know. There's nothing wrong with learning languages. You know, ignorance is something we should all be ashamed of, right, in my opinion. I myself believe that if you're a Buddhist, you should study the sutras. You know, you should really read them, you should read commentaries on them. So I'm not somebody saying knowledge is valueless. I'm saying that if we put so we have put so much faith in and importance on consciousness that we have lost touch with what we call the unconscious life. And so, you know, we have lost that balance, which is the essence of the integrated awareness. So I would say that to be a fully functional human being, let alone a bodhisattva, requires something like a balance between the unconscious and the conscious awareness, right? And we need psychotherapists and therapists and psychiatrists, partly because that balance is so hard to establish, and we pay such a heavy price for not being aware that we need that balance, right? We need that balance. I would say that a healthy human being has a balance between the conscious, his or her conscious life and his or her unconscious life. And that the bodhisattva is someone who has been able to harmonize to a extraordinary degree, to an important degree, those two forms of awareness. So, often, because we're so ignorant of the unconscious mind, of our unconscious lives, of the iceberg beneath the surface, you know, we have what Zen literature calls divided mind. You know, you have been, I'm sure, in situations where you felt like your heart was pulling you in one direction and your head was pulling you in another direction. So I think we've all experienced that divided mind. You know, I've known many people in my capacity as a Zen teacher who struggle with the split between their conscious lives, which they have worked so hard to create and sustain, and their unconscious lives, which they have often pushed aside and don't know how to deal with. They don't know how to deal with it, you know. So I could give you a couple of examples. Many years ago, there was a woman who was studying in our group. And she was very committed to her Zen practice. She was a rather distinguished academic, right? She was, married, had a husband and a kid. And she began to do Zen practice, and you know, sort of at first very tentatively, and then with greater and greater degrees of commitment. And you know, she started coming to Sesshin, and all was going well until, she came into the Dogasan room and said something. This is a sort of a composite figure, okay? So there's not really one person, but please, this kind of thing has happened to me. This person came into the Dokusan room and said, you know, I'm sitting in the Zendo and I find myself attracted to this woman who's sitting across from me in the Zendo. And I can't get her out of my mind, you know, I'm attracted to her. And, you know, basically, it became clear to me she meant I'm romantically attracted to her. And I said, oh, well, you know, that happens all the time. You know, actually, and it does, right? You know, when I was training in the Seattle Zen Center, there was this beautiful woman named Renee who would sit across from me, and I would open my eyes sometime and just think, oh my gosh, what a beautiful woman, you know. What would life be like with her? You know, instead of doing my koan, I'd be thinking, oh, we'd do this, and I'm sure we'd have a wonderful time, and we would walk hand in hand in the park, and, you know, et cetera. And then I'd go, oh, stop it, go back to work, right? You know, so, but, you know, this became like a theme in her practice. And you know, flash forward to another sesshin, like a year later, and you know, she'd say, I've been doing Zen and I'm starting to feel really strongly attracted to a number of women in my life. And you know, this was like terrifying to her. It was terrifying. And I said something like, well, is that so bad? You know, there are many people, many women are attracted to women. You know, that's not such a, it's not a crime. You know, it's not sin, you know. And you know, basically, she basically said at one point, and this went on and on, but she basically said, look, I have to make a choice. You know, I'm married. I have a professional life. I have a daughter. I don't want to destroy my marriage and come out. And, you know, and she didn't want to come out not only to the public, but to herself, right? She had created this identity that was, you know, cisgendered, heterosexual identity. And, you know, she didn't want to be another kind of person. And this is really like a example of what Zen calls a divided mind, right? And you know, I said, you know, I never said, well, you must resolve this issue. I actually said, you know, the truth is that we all live with certain kinds of contradictions, right? Contradictions are part of life. Every koan involves a contradiction. And I said, you know, this may just be a tension you have to balance in your life, you know? It's a free country, and nothing is morally obligating you to come out of the closet. I said, you know, you can be both the things at once. You know, you can be a publicly straight person, you can be a privately gay person, you know, as you wish. You know, there isn't one road. But this was so unbearable to her that she finally said to me, I just have to stop practicing Zen. And you know, this is an example of a divided mind. Now, you know, I would say that this crisis was certainly not her fault, right? But you know, I think all of us have a kind of ignorance of, or even fear of, going under the surface of our consciousness, because we have investments in a certain conscious set of values or a certain a life we've created consciously. And our ignorance about our deeper self, and I'm not just talking about people's sexuality or something like that, I'm talking about the human mind is really quite extraordinarily, it's vast, you know? And, you know, we live in this narrow sliver of consciousness. It's like if you imagine consciousness as a spectrum, like, you know, the spectrum of light, you know, red, orange, green, and so on, you know. We live in one narrow band of visibility, and that's the conscious mind. And when we begin to do Zen, we're learning how to be, we're learning how to enter into a relationship of honesty and openness with our unconscious mind, with our big mind. And, you know, when people go to therapists, they are going to therapists because they have closed the door on their big mind so completely. And they're so afraid of opening it up, see, that they need a little help, because it is actually, you know, it is actually a little scary. You know, people think of meditation just as a kind of thing, it's like a getting some exercise, right? I'm going to sit on the cushion and calm down. And you can treat meditation that way. But, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, you're actually beginning to, like, unpack for what's below the surface of your consciousness. And, you know, one of the reasons people have a hard time doing this by themselves is that that's a challenging process. When you have a psychotherapist with you, you know, you have a trusted other who can begin to guide you in unpacking that. And you know, Zen is also about opening the door into your big mind and beginning to become friends with the part of yourself that you maybe haven't had an opportunity or haven't allowed yourself to be intimate with. So it's like there's a wall between our conscious mind, and we are afraid sometimes, often, actually, of what's on the other side of the wall. And a lot of our lives involve keeping the door closed, right? But when we begin to open that, when we begin to do Zen practice, we learn how to go to the door and open the door and begin to have a healthy relationship with our big mind, with a big mind. And this koan is really about that very thing, right? That very thing. So Yangshan is a Zen master, obviously, who is meeting a monk who has come to his temple. Monk who he doesn't know, and whose level of awakeness or awareness he's not familiar with. So Yangshan asked the monk a Zen question. He says, "Where are you from?" And the monk gives sort of a worldly answer. He says, "From Yu province." Okay. So then Yangshan says, Yangshan's still probing, trying to see where this guy's mind is, and he says, "Do you often think of that place?" And the monk says, "Oh, you know, actually, I think about it all the time." So now Yangshan has a sense of where this person is, right? You know, basically, he has a sense of where this person is in his practice. So then Yangshan says, okay. So he says, look, the thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls, and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thoughts to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there? Okay. So, you know, basically, when we when we are going through our regular life, right, when we're going through our lives, it seems obvious to us that we're seeing the real world, right? So, you know, you get up in the morning and your alarm clock rings and you have to get to work by 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, right? And the alarm clock rings and you see the alarm clock. You jump in the shower, you take a shower, you eat your breakfast, you get in the car, you know, you notice that you are going to have to get some gas on the way home. You know, basically, you go to work and turn on your computer or whatever you might do. You might have to interview people for the day and write reports, or you might have to teach classes. You know, all day long, we're encountering a world of people and things, right? And it seems as though they're fully present for us, or we're seeing things as they really are. You know, if you go for a walk, you know, you might look at the path, you might look at the trees, and you seem to be totally in contact with the world. But you know, the belief that we are seeing the real world when we just look at it is actually mistaken. It's actually mistaken. Let me give you another example. This is one from my own experience. You know, when I first I got married, when I first married Barbara, my wife, you know, after knowing her for like 6 months, I was head over heels in love. And, you know, I remember going on a hike and talking to some people about this woman I'd met that I was in love with, and I was describing her. And I thought, no, this is a really special person. And I also thought, you know, I really know who she is. You know, I really know who this person is. You know, we got married, and then, you know, once you get married, you discover that you don't really know who that person is. You know, it's a commonplace that people will say when their marriage is in crisis, I'm married to a stranger. But actually, you know, when you realize that your partner is a stranger, you're beginning to actually understand your partner and yourself. So you know, I thought my wife was a certain person. And as I lived with her longer and longer, I realized that what I was seeing when I was looking at my wife were my own projections and fantasies and desires. And, you know, as I got to know her more, I realized that those were my fantasies, projections, and desires, and not the reality, the person. You know, and it's so hard to connect to people on an intellectual level. How do I know when I really am encountering another person? You know, I would say most of that encounter happens on a level of feeling or emotion, you know, where you're finding it hard to connect with the other person, and you're groping basically emotionally with your feelings of loss or fear, etc. And then every once in a while we really connect with a person, and it may not even be possible to say how it's happening. And maybe the person connects with us. And you know, it often doesn't have to do with what we're discussing or even what we're doing. It's like my conscious mind and my unconscious mind harmonize, and the unconscious mind and the conscious mind of the other person harmonizes. And it's almost like, you know, the unconscious minds of the two people harmonize, if that makes any sense at all. It's like, you know, sometimes you're having a good relationship with your partner, and it's so hard to say why, but it's like your unconscious mind is speaking to the unconscious mind of the other person. So, I hope I'm making some sense. But, you know, when we no longer know who somebody is and we have to encounter them in an unfamiliar way, you know, often that animates or brings to life deeper intuitive faculties in ourselves that we have to call on. And when we do that, we feel more connected. You know, and this is actually the same thing with the world itself, right? You know, when something is just an object, it's just a car, it's just a tree, you know, we're only experiencing it consciously with our conscious minds. You know, when we encounter something in a way that has a unconscious resonance for us, right? Now we're really experiencing the thing. It's like there are moments in our life when things are no longer just objects, and they begin to come to life for us. We can feel a change in our relationship to them. I for many years, my wife and I had a Volkswagen Bug. And it was a used car that I bought. And we didn't have any money, and we had this old car. And the longer we had that car, the deeper our feelings towards the car became, you know? And, you know, finally the car was so old that the bottom was, you know, we loved that car like a friend, you know? It was like that car was our friend. We loved our Volkswagen, right? We'd gone so many places with it, but it was no longer an object. It had become part of our deeper mental life. And I remember the floor was finally rusting out, you know, and I went to a car place, a repair place, and the guy said it would be thousands of dollars to rebuild the floor. And he said the whole car is falling apart. So we finally just said, okay, you know, take it away. And somebody came up to the house and they hooked up the Volkswagen to a tow truck. And my wife was watching this, and she says, as they pulled the Volkswagen, the engine wasn't turned on, but as they pulled it away, the engine started turning over, and it made little you know, noises, like it was popping noises. And my wife came in the house and cried, right? Now, actually, I think that's a deeper relationship to the world, right? At a moment like that, the car is no longer just a car. It's now alive for us in a deeper way. If this makes any sense at all, you know, when things are alive for us in that way, they have begun to be alive we've begun to bring into harmony the conscious and the unconscious mind. So another example is, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, liked to do something called Sado, which is the way of tea. He was really quite famous. He taught at Ura Senke for many years, and tea was really his passion, even more than Zen. And when he got really interested in tea, at the end of Sesshin, we would all do these interminable tea ceremonies where each person would be served a bowl of tea. I wasn't into tea at all. I just thought, let me out of here. The Sesshin is over. Let me go home, right? But he would do these tea ceremonies, and there's a whole ritual to receiving the bowl and turning the bowl, and it was like so slow, and it drove me crazy. But one day I was doing this, you know, and it was like a psychological transformation. It was like I really disappeared and I became the bowl. I became the tea, right? It was just like I could no longer say where I stopped and the bowl started. there was a fusion of the self and the world. This is what Buddhism calls non-duality. And when we experience non-duality, what that means is that the unconscious and the conscious mind have entered into harmony. And now we don't have a divided mind, we have a unified mind in accord with the way, as it says in the Xinqing Ming. So, this is a monk who has arrived at Yangshan's place, and Yangshan is trying to find out where his mind is, what his level of attainment is, he says, "Where are you from?" "I'm from Yu," isn't that what he says? "I'm from Yu province." And then he says, "Do you think of it often?" And he says, "Yes, I do." And then he says, "When you think of it, it is that's the environment, and the mind that thinks about the environment is the mind." Okay. And he says, So, if you stop thinking about the environment and you look at your own mind, what do you see? And the monk stops for a minute, and he looks at his own mind, at the screen in his head, at the mind's eye, and he sees blankness. And he says, "When I look into my own mind, all I see is emptiness." Now, a person who would say this has been practicing Zen for a long time, actually. I sometimes ask this very question to students when they come into Dokusan. I'll say, "Close your eyes and look at your mind's eye and tell me what you see." And, it takes many years before people say, "I see nothing." Mostly what they'll say is, "I see lunch," or "I see my child, or "I see." So, basically, it takes a long time before you can get to the door of your big mind, right? And so when the monk says, "When I turn my attention back at my mind and I stop thinking of my home in the province of Yu, I see that my mind is completely blank." This is what we in Zen call mu xin. So now Yangshan knows that this is a monk who has achieved mu xin. And so at this point, Yangshan, being a Zen master, doesn't go, "Oh, that's very impressive." But I have to tell you, it is impressive. If you do Zen, you probably think everybody is capable of doing that. But actually, it takes many years of practice before somebody can look into her own mind and see blankness, right? And probably not one in 10,000 ordinary people would answer this way. So it takes great cultivation to be able to see the door to your big mind. But then, Yangshan doesn't say, "Great, that's excellent." What he says is, the monk said, "When I get there, I don't see any existence at all." In other words, mu xin. And now Yangshan says, "This is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of the person." Now it's like, what could that possibly mean? Right. So what he actually says is, "Great, you've made a lot of progress, but just being able to enter into mu xin is not enlightenment. Right? It's not enlightenment. It's the path, but it's not the end point of the journey." So basically, when you have reached that place, you begin to do the work of harmonizing your conscious and your unconscious life. So you can go to a therapist and you can have the therapist tell you things or help you to understand things. But, you know, that's actually a rather superficial relationship with your unconscious mind. It's actually rather, you're still sort of getting, you're still getting a very one-sided, you're still not experiencing directly your relationship with your unconscious mind, with your big mind. So what Yang Shan says is, great, you have learned how to get to Wuxin, to Muxin. But now put it into practice. And when you put it into practice, you gradually dissolve the boundary between your conscious and your unconscious minds. You begin to create a unified mind in accord with the way. So this becomes the path. This is the path, right? So, when people do something like tsado, right, tea ceremony, right? You know, if you practice tsado regularly, first time you do tsado, if you try it, there's a complex ritual, right? It's actually not that complicated, but it has to be done mindfully and sort of impeccably, right? So there's a way to bring in, if you use a tray, there's a way to bring in a tray with the tea whisk and the bowl, and you have to have hot water, a tea caddy, and all of this stuff. And you have to unpack everything in exactly the right way. Then you have to clean the tea ladle, and you clean the bowl, and you pour that into the wastewater receptacle. And it's all highly choreographed. And the first couple of times you do it, or maybe many times, you'll make mistakes. And if you're not mindful, you'll make mistakes, right? So, I forgot. So eventually what happens, though, is that as you do this, you begin to be less and less self-conscious. And it begins to be more and more the case that as you're doing this, your mind is just blank. See, your mind is just blank. And doing the process, going through the ritual, takes you to a blank mind, and then as you're doing it, you're in a blank mind. And when you're in that blank mind and you turn and you look at the person sitting next to you, you realize that that person is really yourself. You experience that person as indistinguishable from yourself. Or, you're sitting in the tea room and you look over at the altar and you see the flowers, the ikebana type arrangement, and you look at the flowers and you realize there's no boundary between myself and the flowers. Or you look down at the green, the froth of green tea, right? And you feel like you're looking in your own face. So when this happens, what we've done is we've harmonized the unconscious and the conscious. And when this occurs, the world is experienced in a very different way. Everything becomes your body. Everything becomes your life. So ordinarily, because we have a division between the conscious and the unconscious minds, we experience everything as separate from ourselves. And, this is why, if you are like me, you like to hike, you like to go out to the national parks. I'll go out to a place like Yellowstone, and I have done prostrations at Yellowstone. I have done bows like at Yellowstone because I think Yellowstone is sacred, right? Sacred. And by myself sometimes I will just do bows and meditate. And this is like sacred. But there are lots of people who would just look at Yellowstone and think, I'd like to cut this down and you know, these trees are worth X number of millions of dollars, and a motel is going to go right here. And you think, how can they have that experience? How can they not feel it, feel the connectedness? And it's because they live too much in the conscious mind, it's an unbalanced mind. So we live in an unbalanced mind, in an unbalanced time. But we're repairing the world, we're making it whole every time we go into Mushin, and then we experience the world as inseparable from ourselves. This is the great body of the Diamond Sutra. Great, but it's like a great body. Everything becomes myself. Everything becomes my body. See? So this is what Yangshan means when he says, you know, he said, in other words, he says, young monk, good work. You know how to enter emptiness. See? But he says, that's all right for the stage of faith, but it's not the stage of the person. See? What he means is, now you have to discover the great body. Through emptiness, everything becomes yourself. The world is yourself. There is not two lives. There's just one world, one life, which we experience as 8 billion separate lives. But that is samsara, not the Pure Land. When we experience everything as inseparable from ourselves, by going into deep mushin, we are all overcoming our sense of separateness and experiencing the living oneness of the world as our own body. See? That's what he means by the stage of the person. See? Okay. And the monk said, do you have any other tips? Okay. Do you have any other tips for practice? And Yangshan says, it's not about tips, right? I can tell you a million different things. You know, explore, strategize, you know, use your own intelligence. But he says, what you have to do is the work of bringing everything that's outside inside, bringing everything that feels separate into the, through the moon gate. See, bring everything into that unity you've experienced when you turn from emptiness back into the world. Every time you do that, you're making your world more whole, and you're making everybody's world more whole. So he says, get to work, young monk. Okay. Yangshan asked a monk, where are you from? The monk said, from Yu province. Yangshan said, do you often think of that place? The monk said, I think of it all the time. Yangshan said, the thinker is the mind and the thought of is the environment. Therein, in the environment, are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thoughts to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there? Do you see sheep and buildings there? And by the way, most people would say, oh yes, I see the movie I saw last night at the Cineplex. But when this monk looks, he says, no, I don't see anything at all. Mushin. Yangshan said, good work. He says, the empty mind is right for the stage of faith, but not for the stage of the person. You're still experiencing the world as separate from yourself. See? You're still experiencing the world is separate from yourself. So that's the stage of faith, but the stage of the person, the one, all things are one body. You have to use Mushin to discover that for yourself. Monk said, don't you have any particular way of guidance? Yangshan said, to say that I have anything particular or not would be inaccurate. Based on your insight now, you know how to get to move, so get to work. He says, you only get this one mystery, Mu. There's one door to repairing the world, it's emptiness. You can take your seat and wear your robe, get to work. After this, keep healing the world. verse, all embracing with no outside. See, one body, all embracing with no outside, penetrating with no obstruction. Gates and walls like cliffs. The gates and walls may be high as cliffs, doors and locks doubly locked. But he says, nevertheless, it's all your, no obstacle is capable of being overcome with emptiness. All emptiness will overcome all senses of separation. Bursting out of the clear sky, the Garuda takes wing on the wind. The Garuda is like a hawk dragon who is the messenger between the heavens and the earth. Treading over the blue sea, thunder follows the roaming dragon. So the Garuda and the dragon are representatives of a unified mind in accord with the way. So please, your excellent sitting today, your sitting was excellent. So keep practicing, keep entering emptiness, keep repairing the world, and you will become a dragon, you will become a Garuda, and the world needs that.
Shujo Buhen Se Gando Ono
So thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen. It looks like several people couldn't stay, but I'm glad you could make it today, and I'm glad